next case for argument is 16-2196, Lummi Tribe v. United States. Mr. Gillingham, good morning.
May it please the court. Plaintiffs ask too much of this statute. And to understand the mismatch between what they ask and what the statute provides, it's important to know what this claim is not. This is not a claim for work performed and not paid for. It's not a claim for work performed after which HUD required that the money be repaid. It's not a claim that from the bank accounts of the tribe they need to repay HUD for excess allocations that were in the line of credit that HUD provided them.
Did you argue the case in front of the Tenth Circuit?
I did not.
All right. If the government prevails in the Tenth Circuit, where they argue that the proper remedy is in the Court of Claims because what is being sought by this precise type of claim is damages. If the government prevails there, then would the government not be judicially estopped from making the very argument you're making here?
Well, what we say there, Your Honor, is that no damages can be awarded because those funds that were appropriated for specific years have already been allocated and they're gone.
No, you're saying what you're saying there is that by definition, it's a request for damages because it's a request from prior years. And you expressly told the Tenth Circuit that the remedy is in the Court of Federal Claims.
There's no remedy in this court now or any court for damages. I think what the Justice Department was saying there was...
In the Tenth Circuit, did you urge that the plaintiffs there need to file their claims in the Court of Federal Claims?
I don't recall that that was our position at all, Your Honor. What we said is, and we don't say here, there is no jurisdiction in the district court. The concern there was they were asking where a district court might have been empowered to issue an order for specific relief. As, for example, in the case of the Navajo tribe, the Navajo recognizing that once these funds are not apportioned to a particular tribe, they go into the pool and they go immediately out to other tribes. What the Navajo did was, in the relevant year, they asked the district court to enjoin HUD from sending those funds away so that they would be there, so that the court could, should it agree with the plaintiffs in that case, it could simply order specific relief and say, now that money that we've set aside, HUD is ordered to put back into that fund for the use of this tribe.
But that's not what's going on in the Tenth Circuit. I mean, I'm surprised that you're telling me you don't know what was argued in the Tenth Circuit because it was so precise and specific. And I could give insight to you pages, but you said if you're talking about funds that you say should have been awarded in prior years, then by definition, that is damages for prior harm, and your remedy is in the Court of Federal Claims. And that's exactly what they're talking about here, which you're now saying to us doesn't give rise to a claim for damages in the Court of Federal Claims.
We said there is no claim for damages. There would be a claim for specific relief were the funds set aside timely by the district court. I think what the Justice Department is concerned with there was that is what the government, that was what the trial court would have had to do. That is what the trial court and Fort Peck did do. It basically said, it basically ordered HUD from all available funds to make the plaintiffs whole. And arguing under the APA's damages exclusion, the Justice Department argued that would be damages. And therefore, it's not cognizable there under this specific.
So the government's position is, as I understand what you're saying, is that the only way the tribes could ever, you know, assuming they are entitled to this fund money, and assuming that the government's failure to provide it to them or or discounting of what was owed was wrong, that the only way they could possibly recover is if they get to district court, essentially in time to know that the government is going to short them and get a mandamus relief or a specific performance relief within that year. Is that what you're saying?
There's plenty, essentially, but it's more than a year. There's plenty of notice and plenty back and forth before these determinations
are made. But if not,
so the tribes have plenty of notice.
But what's your position in the Tenth Circuit? If not, it belongs in the Court of Federal Claims, right?
No, because although the district court would be precluded from awarding damages, which is how we characterize what the court there did, by requiring HUD to go out and search for other funds and make them whole. That is a request for damages, but as we've explained here, damages is not a suitable remedy. It was not intended by Congress in the statute.
But you did say on pages 64 through 68 of your brief in the Tenth Circuit that the remedy is in the Court of Federal Claims. You didn't tell them that if they went to the Court of Federal Claims, you would then argue that, no, they don't have a remedy. You expressly said it's a damages remedy and they need to go to the Court of Federal Claims for that.
And if they had, well...
And if they had, you'd be arguing, no, they can't do that.
As a general matter, it is true that this court has the Court of Federal Claims has jurisdiction over damages claims. What we say, and we argue here, is in fact they have not presented a damages claim that's cognizable under this statute. And they've gone at it in one of two ways. First, they have to show there is a money-mandating requirement. And there's no money-mandating requirement in the statute. There's simply a requirement that to a future fund, a line of credit, a certain amount of money be allocated, but that is necessarily controlled, limited, and subject to a host, a bevy, a dizzying array of regulations. That means the tribes themselves will never see that money. They will only process that money and use that money for the benefit of individual Indian residents who are beneficiaries of the fund. It will never go into their individual bank accounts. Whereas, if a Court of Federal Claims judge issued a judgment for $2 million, say, that money would be paid by the judgment fund and it would go directly into the general fund of the tribes for which they could spend anything.
No, I don't understand that. Why is it that the damages remedy couldn't contain the same strings attached requirements with respect to how the money has to be used?
Because that would require a claims court judge to attach strings to a judgment. If the claims court judges could do that, they could do that with any case and say, well, I'm going to give you this money, but you can only spend it on the following things, and I'm going to apply a special master to watch it. The court can't do that. It simply issues a judgment for $2 million or whatever it is, and the judgment fund will send that, and it will be available to the tribes for whatever reasons they want to put it. It will completely leap over all of the purposes, the limits, and the conditions on the funds that NAHASDA requires.
What's your authority for the fact that a court doesn't have any authority to award specifically directed funds?
Because that is equitable relief, and the court has long been held to have no power to award
specific relief. It has power to order equitable relief as long as it is accompanying a damages award.
In cases like the military pay cases, where there was, first of all, a money-mandating statute, and the court, for example, determines that a military officer was incorrectly passed over for promotion or arbitrarily passed over for promotion contrary to law, the judge will then issue orders making sure that consistent with that order, the paperwork demonstrating that the officer was passed over is removed. That's part of the...
Well, why isn't that equitable relief that goes along with the damages award?
That's long been held to be in aid of a money judgment. And here, you open a door that can never be closed. Here, this is clearly injunctive relief. It clearly requires the judge to step into the shoes, basically provide APA review, and tell HUD what to do. Tell HUD to put the money here and not there. Tell the plan to spend it only this way and not that way. That is unprecedented. We're aware of no such case. And this is not a novel idea. This stems from the fact that these statutes must be money mandating. To do that, we look at Congress's intent. And we say that, first of all,
Congress's intent was to get this money to the recipients, and you're not even debating that some of what HUD did was to withhold money that it shouldn't have withheld.
Well, we are debating. That's a merits question, which Judge Ruging will have to determine. But what we're saying is
that... I know, but we're proceeding on the assumption right now, mm-hmm. that HUD withheld money that it shouldn't have withheld, and that there was a specific purpose that Congress wanted that money to be used for, and HUD didn't allow it to happen.
We agree that there was a specific purpose, and that what Congress intended was not that that money be paid. It could have said shall be paid, is entitled to, shall be made available to. All of the hallmarks of a money mandating statute did not say that here. It said shall allocate. It did not say pay damages or pay the money directly.
So and if the Court of Federal Claims is not the right court, then where could the Court of Federal Claims have transferred this action? To any federal district court?
Well, there is something that could be done by a federal district court still, and that is when this claim was filed, HUD desisted from capturing future money. This is all about a line of credit sitting in the Treasury, which is available to the tribes, and when HUD recaptured the money, there was excess money there, is what Judge Bruggen called it. The HUD agreed not to recapture any further monies, and a district court could order it under its APA jurisdiction not to further recapture those monies, and they would not be recaptured. Now, at this point, frankly, the sums are not substantial. I think one tribe owes nothing, is what the party stipulated below.
Wait, I'm a little confused. There were past years where HUD withheld money from certain tribes, and now those tribes would like to get that money back.
Right.
And where can they go to get that money back?
At this point, they cannot.
Why not?
Because
You say they can't get it here or through the Court of Federal Claims because this statute is not money mandating.
Right.
And you rely on Bowen, you rely on NCMS.
Right.
And you say this is best suited, where this is most appropriately an action under the APA.
Right. There was a time when it was. It would be no different than if the statute of limitations.
When you say, slow down. When you say there was a time when it could be filed, and I'm just trying to understand better, why are you saying it like that? I guess you're saying the tribes are now foreclosed from being able to get that money back through an APA action.
Right. They can present the case. As long as within the statute of limitations, they can present the argument that HUD acted arbitrarily and capriciously and contrary to statute.
Before you go into the abstract theory, explain to me just factually what's defective about their ability to go into district court. I mean, what blocks us or the Court of Federal Claims from transferring this case, this civil action, into district court?
Right. The court could transfer it, and the question that could be entertained was whether HUD would be entitled to recapture any funds yet uncaptured. What the court
I don't know what that means, recapture funds yet uncaptured. I don't know what that means.
HUD calculated that there was there was an improper overpayment to the tribes, and it began to recapture it after giving the tribes notice and discussing how they would like to have that adjusted. And in all cases, it was by adjusting future grants, basically. And so at some point when this was filed, the government said, we will stop setting aside those monies. So we regard this as money you're going to owe, but we're not going to grab it and we're not going to set it off in future years until we hear from
the court. But right now, I'm just really focused on the money that HUD already has grabbed.
Right.
And so just focus on that.
And what we say is the court could entertain that question, but in the end, it will be able to grant no remedy. And that's what we're saying in the Tenth Circuit. Because to the extent money has been set aside, and to my knowledge, it has not been.
When you say money has been sent, use active voice? I don't understand.
So
who is setting aside money? Who is taking money? Where is the money located? I can't follow.
In the Fort Peck case, and in the Navajo case as well.
No, just talk about the facts of this case in front of
us. The tribes could have gone in. These three tribes could have gone in, could have asked a district court to enjoin HUD.
When could they?
Before the monies were transferred. After they.
When was the money retransferred?
Monies were transferred between, the debts were determined to be between 1988 and 2009, and in various years, partial payments were made.
What do you mean partial payments were made? Who made what payments?
No payments were made. HUD deducted from the line of credit that's sitting at the Treasury for the tribes funds to account for the fact that they had it over. Allocated in prior years. They simply deducted from their line of credit. That's all that happens. However, 25 U.S.C. 4151 says the secretary must allocate any funds made available in the fiscal year. So once one tribe is determined not to be eligible for an FCAS set aside, the first part of the allocation formula, it then goes to other tribes. In other words, that money is...
But what about the fact that the district court specifically found out in the Tenth Circuit that HUD treats all of this money as fungible? In other words, that you keep trying to say it has to be in this particular year, and if you miss that window for your mandamus relief, you're done. And yet, HUD admittedly treats all this money as just one big grant pile, which is what Congress wanted it to do. And so why does it matter?
And we disagree with that in the Tenth Circuit. Perhaps what the district court was talking about, with which we would agree with him, is once those monies are allocated to a tribe, once the 98 money, the 99 money, the 2000 money is allocated, it sits in a line of credit and fluctuates. And that money, and there's no requirement that the tribes remit that money. However, the principle of an appropriation is it's only available in the year in which Congress appropriates it. And by law, HUD is required to send that money out to all eligible tribes. If one tribe's not eligible, it goes to the rest. So as a matter of congressional intent, that money...
You're saying at the end of every fiscal year, all the money is exhausted? There's no money left over that carries over into the next fiscal year?
There's some lag as to when...
Is that what you're saying?
Yes, basically, yes. And basically...
Are you saying that you've never used money from subsequent fiscal years to pay to tribes that underpayments, to make up underpayments? I think there was a specific finding of fact to that effect in the Tenth Circuit. That the HUD actually goes back and makes from later years allotments, pays back some underpayments.
Not to my knowledge, that those must be appropriated for the years in question based upon how the formula turns out that year. In this case, HUD adjusted down against balances that existed. I'm not aware, and I'll check with my agency counsel, who's the expert here, of whether they've ever adjusted up.
Can I just summarize, therefore, the government's view is that even though they said in the Tenth Circuit this should go to the Court of Claims, they really didn't mean it, and therefore it doesn't belong in the district court, but it also doesn't belong in the Court of Claims either. Right.
The Court of Claims can entertain damages cases for sure, but in this case, under this statute, Congress did not intend this to be money mandating, and therefore the court could not award damages in this case.
So the answer to my question is yes, that's right. The government's view.
That there's no court that can provide any relief.
In the absence of them coming in for a preliminary injunction to district court in the first year while the appropriations are still available.
More than a year. It takes a while for these things to be notices are given and well, notifies. But yes, beyond that, yes. Then the district court can provide specific relief as against those funds. It can report that money, which is set aside, must be paid over. You can call that damages if you want, but that can be done.
But only in that window.
Only for the money.
So you're saying we should send this to the district court because that's the one that has jurisdiction, but then the district court won't have any authority to give a remedy.
Because that money has not been set aside, that's the unfortunate truth. It's no different than if the statute of limitations is run. That would be the proper court, but once the statute's run, the court lacks power to do it.
But there is no statute of limitations that is run.
Yeah, what do you mean by statute of limitations?
I'm simply saying that as a general matter, we're making a distinction between what this court does versus what a district court does. Well, the district court can entertain these cases, could issue injunctions, could order remedies in the form of specific relief. Just because that has that power does not mean it has that power on this date, analogous to a statute of limitations problem.
So it's an analogy to statute of limitations.
Only analogous. Here the problem is because the time is run and because in the time available, the tribes did not set aside this money as a fund at which the district court could aim specific relief.
This seems pretty global, right? I mean, I don't know. We had the Bowen case, and we also had the more recent case in our court. I mean, there are thousands and thousands of statutory grant programs that are divvied up on an annual basis.
Right, that's right.
So is are there any limiting principles? Is your view that if there's a statutory grant, allotment of money, then therefore it is not in the nature of a court of claims money mandating statute and could only go to the district court? And since we're dealing with annual appropriations, the only way you can get relief in the district court is if you get in there on a preliminary injunction or mandamus basis before the money is otherwise expended for that fiscal year.
The limiting principle is not that if there is a grant, the court of claims has no jurisdiction. We have to examine the particular grant. And in cases like Greenlee County, Chula Vista, Kanemoto, those cases found that money was intended to be paid because they use, those were clearly compensation. They use words like shall pay or are entitled to or it's compensation for. And so in those, so you examine the statutes.
But so here your assessment is the money was not intended to be paid?
To be paid, to be deposited in the general account, which is where judgment fund damages will go of the tribe. It must remain only in the account that is subject to all the controls over those funds that ensure that they are expended only for the benefit of the beneficiary.
But you didn't brief anything in your briefs about this question of the scope of the Court of Federal Claims authority with respect to a distinction between general fund damages or payment of monies that could be paid consistent with the requirements of the statute.
What we've said is that the funds that are available under this statute through the Treasury line of credit are basically funds with strings attached, subject to limitations. What we refer to as the damages claim is no strings money. A judgment fund simply paid for the account of $2 million.
I mean, you made that factual distinction, but what I'm saying is you don't anywhere give us any legal authority for the proposition that there is no, that there is no ability to allow the payments to be made consistent with the statutory scheme, even if they're characterized as damages.
Because that would clearly be a matter of injunction. It would be the court attaching strings to a judgment. And that would require enforcement by the court. It would require the appointment of some sort of a special master or someone to observe whether those strings were attached. That would open up a door that cannot be closed and would be dangerous.
When you award the money on a yearly basis, do you have a special master that supervises the tribes to make sure that they go to the correct places?
HUD does that.
HUD can do it, right? Why can't HUD do that the same way it does for every other award of money?
Because the money would be written into, it would be free and clear money. A judgment is simply money in compensation for a past injury. It'd be given to the plaintiff. The plaintiff could do anything they want with it. So you're asking the court to order to basically issue an injunction and say, okay, we're going to give you this money, but you must make sure it's deposited over in this account, and I'm instructing HUD to work with you to ensure it goes in an account where HUD can keep an eye on it.
The government's view in trying to figure out where cases should be filed, that there are money damages cases, and money damages cases are always filed in the Court of Federal Claims, and then there's specific equitable relief type cases where you're trying to get certain kinds of funds, but they're characterized for whatever reason as specific equitable relief, and then therefore those are APA actions. So is it always the case in the government's view that you can only file in one court and not the other, that you either have to figure out whether it's a money damages case or an equitable relief case? And if it's one, then it's in the federal claims. If it's the other, then it must be an APA action in district court.
And I think this court has addressed that.
Is the answer yes?
You must figure out whether the Court of Federal Claims has jurisdiction. If it is money mandated.
Let me ask it a different way. Is there ever a situation where it would be permissible to file a claim in either court, federal claims or district court? Because maybe on one hand it's considered equitable relief, on the other hand it could be considered a naked money judgment. And so therefore, under certain circumstances, there is overlap in terms of jurisdiction between the federal claims and the district courts?
Yes, I suppose. I mean, the plaintiff owned his complaint. And if the plaintiff needs equitable relief, it would go to district court. There's no question about it.
Oh, wait a minute. But I thought, doesn't the APA provide for relief because it's not available in any other court? So if it's available in the court
of... This is the question of Boeing, which I don't want to oversell here. We're beginning to characterize what's damages and what's not. If there's a money mandating statute and the plaintiff wants money, it can come to the court of federal claims. If it wants equitable relief in order, for example, in future years to tell HUD to do certain things, it goes to the court and get that. That may have a money consequence, but that certainly is not a money mandating claim resulting in the direct payment of money. The court has made that distinction clear over the years. So in theory, a plaintiff could need equitable relief. That might be more important to it, and it might go and seek that in the court. If it asks for what it characterizes equitable relief for money, then this court gets into the business of looking at the true nature of the complaint and seeing what is this really about, as this court did in NCMS, and it does all the time. And if it determines what the plaintiff really wants is simply money, basically for past injuries, and the statute's money mandating, then the Court of Federal Claims has jurisdiction.
So what would be the fact pattern where the government believes, okay, a certain plaintiff could file this case, well, given its true nature in either the federal claims or the district court? What would that fact pattern be?
The Fort Peck claim that HUD arbitrarily and capriciously applied a void stat regulation 318, which concerns allocation, or valid misapplied it. That was, we didn't say that the jurisdiction is proper in the district court. And that question could have been ironed out. And once it was, HUD, at least in the 10th Circuit, would have been bound by that finding, at least as to that claim.
That claim could also have been filed in the Court of Federal Claims? That's my question.
No, because I'm talking, so, no, again, because that would be under
right,
the
so my, I don't know, I'm trying
I
to.
I thought the answer was that you can't file the same claim. I understood your answer to be that if you've got a different cause of action,
right,
one cause for prospective relief
right,
and the other
right,
for damages,
yes,
one case involving parties,
right,
parts of it can go in the Court of Claims and part of it can go in the district
that's
court.
Right. That's
but
right,
it isn't the case, is it, that the precise claim, what you're seeking, can go alternatively to a district court or to the Court of Federal Claims, right?
I think that's a metaphysical question that was left open by the Supreme Court in Boeing. However, no case can be here if a money mandating statute is not cited. If a money mandating statute is cited, money can be had here. There would be an adequate remedy, and therefore the APA would automatically be divested of jurisdiction.
Unless you were seeking some additional relief, like injunctive
right,
relief.
That's right.
Can I
agree.
We are way over time, but I think we need to talk a little about the
sure,
illegal exaction claim.
I'd love to.
Because it's entirely unclear to me. I mean, you won that below.
Right.
And now you're raising it here. I mean, is that question on appeal before us? And if so, let's talk about the merits of that claim.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And the question, when this court grants certiorari, it cited a case called Yamaha, a Supreme Court case, and basically said any question cited in Judge Brueggen's September 30, 2015 order could be reviewed. Perhaps we took the bait, or in opposing the motion for our motion for our petition for certiorari, the plaintiff raised this illegal exaction question, and we addressed it up front. And perhaps we should later than the last couple of weeks.
Well, you're not talking about a petition for certiorari. You're
petition for interlocutory appeal. And so it's unsettled in this district, in this court. This court cited the Yamaha case, and that basically says that when we're sort of in a final appeal situation, a party that does not file a notice of appeal cannot reduce the rights of its adversary, basically. And that's a lot.
Okay, but assuming it's properly before us.
Right.
On the merits of the illegal exaction claim. Now, I understand this is a little different because the claim is for a violation of due process. But can you talk to us a little about the claim for illegal exaction and whether that claim exists, what the relationship is between whether or not the statute is money mandating and whether there's a claim for illegal exaction?
Right. So assuming that the failure to file a notice of appeal does not preclude that question, the answers are this. First of all, Judge Brueggen said basically, this is superfluous at this point. If the money is not there, there's nothing to be exacted. He also did not cite cases. I believe he was talking about, he would have been correct to talk about two general principles. First of all, in order to have an illegal exaction, someone's money has to be exacted. So cases like Argentina Aerolíneas Argentina, where the plaintiff was required to pay over its own money to a third party to house aliens seeking asylum, or in the case of the case cited by the plaintiff, North California Power, where the Bureau of Reclamation required payments to be made that it had no authority to make, or in other cases like
Drawing the distinction between payments that were withheld, as in this case, versus payments that were clawed back.
Basically, we say the plaintiff had, the tribes had to have the money, have possession of the money, have legal right to the money, and then the government forced them to pay it over to the government. It did not. Of course, the money that was sitting in their line of credit, when not properly allocated, simply went off to other tribes. No, the government doesn't have the plaintiff's, the tribe's money in its pocket.
But it's not so much that the government doesn't have the tribe's money in its pocket, because that gets into the whole question about how, whether money is money and whether it's been treated as fundable by HUD. I thought that what the judge said was that the distinction is between, like, for instance, where you make a taxpayer pay money and the taxpayer is trying to get it back, that that would be a classic exaction versus a situation in which the government just didn't make a payment that it should have made.
Right. So in the tax cases, those are the classic cases.
But isn't that the distinction the judge drew?
Judge Brueging was basically saying this was never their money. They would have to establish it was their money in the first instance, which takes us right back to the question of whether...
Establish that they didn't have the right to the money. What they didn't establish was that they had the money in their pocket and were forced to hand it back.
Well, the words they use, I think, were substantively entitled to it. In the tax cases, there's no question the money in the tax account is the taxpayer's. The taxpayer's earned that money and it's simply been lodged on the taxpayer's behalf with the IRS. And when the IRS refuses to return it, a Replevin-style action under a theory of legal exaction is proper. Here, we say the money was never owned by the tribe, never paid over to the tribe. At best, there might have come a time
When did Judge Brueging say that? I mean, you're saying that the Court of Federal Claims below said that this was never money that belonged to the tribe, and so therefore there can't be an illegal exaction. My understanding of what the judge below said was that it wasn't the loss of a procedural right that caused any legal exaction. It was the substantive provisions of NASDA that caused, or misapplication of the substantive provisions that caused illegal exaction. So that's what I saw his reasoning was. I didn't see any reasoning that suggested that this money doesn't ever belong to the tribes.
The words he used on page 14 and 17 of the Joint Appendix in Moving 4 was that first of all, the tribe would have to show that it's substantively entitled to the money. And in Lumi, on JA5, he said the government only has the plaintiff's money in its pocket if 318, the allocation statute, was improperly applied. That gets to the second. So you have to have money to begin with that is yours, that's been taken, is the first element. The second element is whether the government has misapplied or misinterpreted the statute, and as a result of that misinterpretation or that or misapplication, the government then takes that money. It then becomes the court's job to examine that particular law and see whether that particular law necessarily implies a money judgment. So the tribes here refer to two sorts of statutes. One is 4165. That's the one that talks about the hearing that we don't agree was due in this case, but nonetheless we assume that it is due. There's nothing in 4165 that can be read as Congress's intent that if a hearing isn't held concerning these allocations in a line of credit, that the necessarily then any money they would have claimed during that hearing must be returned to them, not only to the funds that are subject to all these controls, but must be put in their personal bank accounts. There's nothing in 4165 that suggests that. That is, it is not necessarily
so. So there's no relief for their failure to hold the hearing, even though it's statutorily required.
There's no money remedy implied in the statute. There's no basis for an illegal
exaction. What's the remedy then?
Well, again,
the statute says, you know, secretary is going to hold these hearings or opportunity for a hearing. And then after that, if it concludes that, you know, there was some misallocation, then it shall do the withholding.
Right.
This is so actually, there's a condition to the act of the secretary withholding the money, and that condition is having an opportunity for the tribe to have a hearing. What's the remedy when the hearing doesn't happen?
Again, you can go to a district court. Well, the proper rule here, the regulation, I believe it's 336, provides that the tribes can seek reconsideration by the assistant secretary. The assistant secretary disagrees. That is final agency action and could be taken to the district court. Now, plaintiffs say it's 4165 is their remedy. But the bottom line is this court would have to find in 4165 a necessary implication that the failure to hold a hearing requires the payment of $2 million, whatever the amount is they're seeking, let's say approximately $2 million, in cash into their bank accounts. There's nothing in the law that can possibly be suggested.
Does HUD have a normal practice now or a common practice of just never giving an opportunity for a hearing?
No, not at all. In fact,
so are you saying this was a rare exception? That the Lummi tribe here just only got a letter notifying them of this withholding, but without giving them an opportunity to be heard?
Well, as Judge Weiss found,
is this a rare exception to the very, very normal conventional practice of HUD to offer an opportunity for a hearing before they do the withholding?
If there was a missed hearing, I've not surveyed this, I would assume it would be HUD believed that it did the proper thing in this case. There was lots of back and forth as Judge Weiss found, Lummi 2. And so when they first pled it as just a failure to follow procedures, he basically said, look, you've agreed with all these things. What would be the purpose of having a hearing? He would also have to find that they requested the hearing and under the regulation they claim here. And he found they had not requested the hearing. But even assuming they had, it's hard for me to believe, honestly, that if they had requested a hearing, that HUD would simply say, we're not going to provide you a hearing. That is not at all in the tenor of all the correspondence that's gone back and forth, which shows, among other things, that if HUD received any sort of an explanation at all for the monies at issue, it simply allowed them to be counted in the FCAS formula. So I can't accept the premise that HUD is denied rights here, but let's just assume that there was a failure to apply by negligence or otherwise 4165. And I would have to assume, because I assume government officials act according to law and properly, that statute would then have to provide as a necessary implication, the court would have to draw an ineluctable conclusion that Congress intended that the remedy to be, if you don't get this hearing, you get $2 million in cash-free money. That's our concern.
Can you give us the cites to where the evidence is that it's clear that there was something that was going on in the back and forth between HUD and the tribes that shows evidence of something that's akin to a sufficient notice and opportunity to be heard?
Judge Weiss found that in his Lummi 1 decision.
What page?
I'll have to go pull let's see if I have it in my notes here, Your Honor. In the Lummi 1 decision at page 599, so this is 99 Fed Claim 584, he said, it's difficult to understand how plaintiff reasonably can assert that HUD failed to provide procedural protections when, in fact, they were given full notice of the government claims along with a meaningful opportunity to respond.
Could you give me the site again? 599 Fed Claim.
Yes, so Lummi 1 is 99 Fed Claims. 584 is the opening page. 599 is where I found that. Okay. Now, in Lummi 2, to be frank, Judge Weiss, after the complaint was refashioned to include this illegal exaction claim under 4165, he said that he held that 4165 hearing should have been held. However, he did not grant summary judgment on that.
Right. I mean, he made that specific finding that there was no hearing and that there should have been a hearing.
Right. That's right. And we disagree with that, and there was never any conclusion as to what remedy would be required because the tribe didn't file motions for summary judgment indicating that as a result of that failure, they were therefore entitled to the money sought. Judge Bruging sort of obviated that. Well, it was presented to Judge Bruging when the tribe said, all right, Judge Weiss has said that we're entitled to this hearing. We now say that as a matter of law, per se, the failure to give that hearing, Judge Wee said, was required automatically means we get the money. And Judge Brueggemann said that's not right. And in fact, an illegal exaction claim is not going to matter here. What's going to matter is whether you have a right to the substantive money you're claiming.
Well, what Judge Brueggemann actually said was that all of that still depends on whether the statute's money mandating. That there may be some remedy for the failure to give a hearing, but only if the statute happens to be money mandating.
Right. He would have to find... I wouldn't use the term money mandating, but I suppose it's a fair shorthand. And what he would have had to have been saying was, by necessary implication, that statute requires the payment of money.
Okay. We've exceeded any bounds of reasonableness in terms of time, but while we restore a few minutes for rebuttal, let's hear from the other side.
I appreciate it, Your Honor.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is John Fredericks. I represent the respondents.
Are you involved in any of the other cases in the other circuits, the 10th or the 9th?
I am, Your Honor. I was involved in the very first case, the Fort Peck case that was brought in the district court. And I also represent 10 plaintiffs in the case that is currently pending before the 10th Circuit.
And it's been pending for quite a while, right, before the panel?
Yes. We brought the Fort Peck case in 2005, I believe. And we brought this case in 2008 after the NAHASTA was amended. And we brought this case under the amended version of the statute that allowed us 45 days to file a claim challenging the HUD's actions. And so
the Act has a 45-day limit to filing a claim?
In the amendment, yes. It basically changed the allocation formula in response to the district court's ruling in Fort Peck that HUD acted in violation of the original statute, so Congress amended the statute. But it also said that tribes that were aggrieved by prior misdeeds could bring an action within 45 days of the amendment, and that's what we did here.
But so the government is saying that despite that 45-day window, there is no place that the tribes can go to get relief for prior actions.
That's what the government's saying, Your Honor, but with all due respect to the government, I think they're clearly wrong. This case could clearly be brought in the Court of Claims because NAHASTA is a money-mandating statute, and two, because we asserted a claim for an illegal exaction, which is an independent basis for claims court jurisdiction.
Well, before we get to the illegal exaction piece of this, we've got precedent in our court, namely the National Center for Manufacturing Sciences. We've also got the Katz case. Why are they distinguishable from this case? Because it seems to me the statute is similar in terms of what it provides and how it provides it. And so how would you distinguish the two?
Well, in national manufacturing, the issue was not whether the Court of Claims had jurisdiction. The issue is whether the district court had jurisdiction under the APA. And nowhere in the
But court, it also reversed the district court's transfer of that case to the Court of Federal Claims.
Right, and it said the question is whether this case properly belongs before the district court or before the Court of Claims.
It did, and it decided that the district court was the proper forum because the complaint that the plaintiff filed did not request a bare, naked money judgment. It also requested injunctive relief prospectively going forward. In our case, we're not asking for any type of prospective injunctive relief. We're just asking the court to issue a judgment for the money that we're owed under the statute and also to issue a judgment for the funds that were unlawfully retained
now,
or exacted.
In that national manufacturing case, as well as the Bowen majority opinion, they seem to characterize federal grant programs that the granting of these monies to subsidize future expenditures as not really being, if you're denied those grant monies, it's not something that is compensable as some substitute relief for some injury or loss or labor, but it's something that's more considered specific equitable relief when you're trying to get that money that you feel like you were unfairly denied in these federal grant programs. And well, so I guess the problem one concern I have is, how do we regard that as a money mandating statute here when we've already said and described federal grant programs as, or loss under a federal grant program as something, when you're looking for relief, it's not necessarily money damages relief, but it's some kind of specific equitable relief.
Well, I think that it all depends on how the plaintiff fashions the complaint and what the relief that the plaintiff asks for. Bowen simply recognized that there are certain cases where, under the APA, a plaintiff could ask for monetary relief, but it didn't hold that that request for relief would somehow divest the claims court of jurisdiction in a case where it would otherwise have jurisdiction to award damages. What Bowen said was, and in fact what National Manufacturers said, is that they weren't convinced that mere money damages would give the plaintiff all the relief to which they were entitled, and therefore the district court had jurisdiction under the APA. Here,
what is your response, though, to the argument from your friend on the other side that the real problem here is if we treat these prior years' misallocations as damages, that instead of complying with the statutory provision that says that the grant amounts for the tribe go directly to the recipient, that in this case the Court of Federal Claims would be forced to simply award monies from the general fund to the tribes, and there would be no ability to control how the tribes used the money?
Well, I think we've got three responses to that, Your Honor. First, I would say in response that issue's not relevant for jurisdictional purposes, that the issue is whether or not NAHASDA mandates the payment of money. We think clearly it does.
I know we're fighting and you know, there was discussion about metaphysical arguments, but whatever that means, but we're talking about jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. But I can't help but have a little bit of concern about saying, is this just a shell game? So the question is, what court should this go to? The government's response is, well, we can argue over which court it goes to, but it doesn't matter because they get nothing in either court, is what they're saying.
Yes. And I hope that's not the law. I don't think it's the law. I would say that it's not the law.
Well, what is the answer to your question? The big concern the government seems to have is whether or not, if we treat it as damages, that the ability of HUD to actually conform to the requirements of the statute that the money goes directly to the recipients is completely wiped out.
Well, the first of all, all of the plaintiffs or the respondents in this case operate under an enabling ordinance that restricts how they can spend the money. They're required to spend their money on affordable housing for low-income individuals. Secondly, if HUD has this concern, they certainly could have asked the court, or they can ask the court, and we would stipulate that any judgment would contain what I would consider ancillary or collateral relief that requires the money to be spent on affordable housing activities in accordance with NAHASDA. I think that's clearly...
Okay, so as I understand it, you have two responses. One is that it really doesn't matter because it's not a question of the tribes getting money and being able to put it in a casino. Mm-hmm. It's a question of this particular tribal organization that has to spend all of its money on affordable housing getting the judgment, right?
Yes.
And that... Secondly, you're saying that regardless of any limits on the court's authority to order strings attached, that as long as parties are allowed to, can agree to strings attached, then the court could implement that.
Yes. And in fact, even if we didn't agree, I think that the court has the authority under either the Tucker Act or under... Statute 28 U.S.C. Section 1503 to require...
The concern I have is that in both Bowen and in National Manufacturing, one of the reasons why both those cases concluded that what was being sought was specific equitable relief was they were looking at the nature of the funds and the relationship between the federal government and the plaintiff in those cases was an ongoing relationship where the federal government had a right to continue monitoring how the block grant money was being used by the plaintiffs there. And that's similar to what's happening here with these HUD funds in the sense that HUD, under the statute, has the right to continue monitoring everything and the tribes are restricted in how they're supposed to use the money, and HUD has the right, if it sees that the money is not being used for the restricted purposes, to then withdraw money or even terminate any future grants. And so, in the end, because there's an ongoing relationship between the tribes and the federal government, which is akin to the ongoing relationships between the federal government and the plaintiffs in those other cases, that was, in those cases, a large part of the basis for why they found that what's going on here with these grants is specific equitable relief. So that's my concern with your case, that it seems to fall into that same kind of ongoing relationship bucket that in the other cases drove a conclusion that it was equitable relief that those plaintiffs were looking for. So why aren't we required to look at your situation as also looking for equitable relief, even though you want to characterize it as money damages?
Well, again, I would say in response that the plaintiff is the master of his complaint, and the Tucker Act is very specific as to what claims are cognizable in the Court of Claims. I think the line to draw between Bowen and the National Manufacturer case and our case is that in both of those cases, the plaintiffs were not simply seeking a naked money judgment. They were also seeking prospective injunctive relief that would require HUD to take, or the government to take, certain actions. Here, in our case, we're not asking for any type of prospective injunctive relief because the damage has already occurred. They denied my client's funding for homes that my clients had to maintain and operate.
But any money that you would get from any court would not have no strings attached. There would always be strings attached under the statute. There would always be a monitoring that the federal government would be required to conduct over any funds that you would collect from the federal claims or from district court.
Well, in the case where the Court of Claims would issue a money judgment, I think that it's an order saying that how these funds can be used is corollary or ancillary to the Court of Claims jurisdiction. I think clearly that the court has that jurisdiction to tell my clients how it can spend the money. My clients are going to spend the money in accordance with their charters. They have to. And again, we would obviously stipulate that we would spend the money for affordable housing activities under NAHASDA. We're simply asking that the money that we weren't paid and the money that HUD took back be returned to us. And if you want to couch it as compensation, we can certainly do that because it's compensation for my clients spending the money to own or to maintain those units in those past funding years when they weren't funded for those units. That's the crux of the case.
Why don't we turn to a legal exaction now and the arguments you want to make? I mean, the claim for legal exaction is really solely a due process claim, right? It's that you were deprived your right for a hearing. So where does that take you? How do we get from that to the damages I presume that you're seeking here?
Well, our claim for an illegal exaction is based upon a specific violation of the regulations under Section 4165 of NHASDA. And I want to note that the passage in Lummi 1 that counsel cited was actually vacated by Judge Weiss
in
Lummi 2. And Judge Weiss clearly said that HUD can't recapture funds outside of the confines of the regulatory scheme under Section 4165. And if they do, it's an illegal exaction of funds. It's not just a due process claim. If you look at the regulations under 4165, they're very specific, and they actually prohibit HUD from recapturing money unless HUD takes certain actions, and those actions are meant to give the housing authorities the right to correct a deficiency before they recapture funds. The deficiency in this case was the housing authorities' failure to remove dwelling units from their formula current assisted stock that had been conveyed or, in HUD's eyes, were eligible for conveyance. There's a dispute as to whether they were eligible for conveyance or not, and that's going to be tried on the merits. But those regulations are very specific, and they prohibit HUD from doing what they did unless HUD complies with those regulations.
Right, and that's the essence of an illegal exaction, is that the government has to comply with certain procedural requirements before they can either deny or recapture funds.
Yes.
Having said that, the mere fact that a procedural requirement isn't complied with, does that standing alone, is that enough if, in fact, upon analysis, that even with the hearing, the result would have ended up being the same?
I think that under this court's case in Stanley, that it is, that where a regulation specifically prescribes an agency from taking money, and the agency does so anyway in violation of that regulation, the implicit remedy is a return of the funds.
What was the facts of Stanley?
Stanley was a case where the government, I think, took back unpaid taxes.
Right.
In based on a procedure that the government wasn't authorized to use. We think the same applies in this case. And Judge Weiss, we think, correctly found that's the case. And we certainly believe that whether or not NHASDA's money mandating has nothing to do with our illegal exaction claim. The two are independent. I see I'm out of time.
Okay. Any further? Thank you very
much. Thank you.
So could you just go back to what are the mechanics of what a tribe needs to do to perfect an APA claim? They get the money withheld from them, and then what happens? What do they have to do in the government's view?
They file a claim in district court alleging the action.
But when? How soon? How soon does it have to be?
Within the APA statute of limitations. I'm sorry, I don't know that off the top of my head.
Well, that's
within
6 years.
But you said
years.
Even the statute of limitations doesn't save you. You said if you file within the statute of limitations, you still have no remedy if you don't get it during that actual year.
Well, first of all, there is a remedy under the regulations to seek the Secretary's agreement that the money is owed. And if it is, the money will be restored. And I want to correct something I said earlier. You asked whether, Judge, you asked whether the money could ever be adjusted upwards. And this is the regulation we say applies, and this is the one that the tribes were informed they could apply under to the Assistant Secretary. And I believe Mr. Peoples actually wrote, had correspondence with two different Assistant Secretaries under these provisions. In any event, 24 CFR 1000.336, and I'm looking at the one that was effective until May 21st, 2007, says, pursuant to resolution of the dispute, this is in paragraph B2, little one, if the Indian tribe or TDHE, tribally designated housing entity, prevails, an adjustment to the Indian tribe's or TDHE's subsequent allocation for the subsequent year shall be made retroactive to include only disputed fiscal years. So if there was a dispute that in a past year the money was improperly
Right, so my point about the money being treated as somewhat fungible because you can take it from other years was correct.
It would be made out of the current year, so the formula for the current year. So if the Secretary decided in 2017 that he'd made a mistake in 2016, he could say, okay, for the 2017 formula, you get the FCAS amount, you get the need amount, and you get the upward adjustment.
But from what you were saying, that still is coming out of a subsequent year. And what you said before means that you can't get it.
This regulation says that in a subsequent
year... Okay, so you were wrong. What you told us before was wrong.
What I'm saying is the appropriation for the money has to be used in the current year. So the 2017 funds...
You know, you say that, but the statute itself actually contemplates that the appropriations are not all used. I mean, the statute itself says you report at the end of every year to Congress about how much grant money is left over.
Right,
so the notion that you're throwing it all out in any given year and you're dividing it all up and you never have another penny left that hangs over doesn't seem to make any sense because the statute doesn't contemplate that.
No, the tribes are not required. You're right. The tribes are not required to return that money. However, in a given year's allocation, it's that year's situation, that year's count of assessment of need and assessment of the currently assisted housing stock that will make the determination for that year. As I said, the regulation
The statute also contemplates that money will not always be spent and there would be money left over.
There can be money left over. That is in the tribe's line of credit, and they're not required to return it. So if they were given $1 million and they only spend $800,000, they have $200,000 going forward.
Well, that's a difference. That's the tribe's carryover.
Right.
I'm talking about that's a different portion of the statute. I'm talking about the portion of the statute that says that that HUD will report to Congress all the monies it didn't allocate. And so you're saying to me that you allocate every single penny and you're required to allocate every single penny doesn't seem consistent with the
under
statute.
Under 4150, there could be a mismatch. And for example, appropriation may not come out until January of a fiscal year, so it's already 6 months late. Then the tribes have to actually submit their Indian housing plans. They could be late. So at the end of a given year, it could very well be that the money has not been spent yet. But the money is dedicated for that year. That's not to say one day after the year it could not be spent.
Can we go back
4151 says all available funds. So 4151, for each fiscal year, the Secretary shall allocate any amounts made available for assistance under this Act for the fiscal year in accordance with the statute.
You started by reading off a CFR site. Why doesn't that change the calculation with respect to whether or not the statute is money mandating? If indeed what I heard you saying is, 10 years later they can go back and get relief in terms of damages for money that is owed to them.
Not damages, though. What this says is the Secretary has the power. If the Secretary agrees that there an adjustment needs to be made, the Secretary can make the adjustment retroactive to include only the disputed fiscal years. If the Secretary says...
So then you're saying, that the district court could do that as an equitable matter, so that what you argued to the district court in the Tenth Circuit was wrong.
Could if this, and this final agency action, my assistant secretary is deemed to be, I think it says final agency.
Right, so the regulation action. Says or contemplates that the secretary has the power to refund money from a different appropriation year than the appropriation year where the secretary incorrectly withheld funds.
Right.
Is that the understanding of that reg?
Adjustment will be made.
Okay.
For the current year.
But you're saying a district court wouldn't have the power to do that.
If the district court determined that
the secretary has the power to do it.
Right.
See regulation. District court doesn't have the power to do that.
The district court could say the secretary acted arbitrarily and capriciously in failing to make the adjustment. And therefore,
but then how does that square with you telling the 10th Circuit that that would constitute money damages and so they can't award it?
It would not be money damages. What the Department of Justice was reacting to there was an order by the district court to pay from all allowable funds. And that they thought was an award or called for the award of damages.
But they were talking about allowable funds under this program, not allowable funds like out of the general fund.
And my understanding of the case was there was only a certain number of years for certain tribes had been set aside, subject to an order of the court to order that money to be paid to the tribe. And so there was no question with respect to those funds. The court had jurisdiction.
Right, but those aren't the funds we're focused on in the 10th Circuit case. The funds we're focused on in the 10th Circuit case are the funds that they're for the back money that the tribes wanted there that the government is refusing to give and claiming that there's no right under an APA action because in their view, the tribes are trying to get that money out of a different appropriation year than the appropriation year in which the money was withheld. That's the part of the case we're focused on.
My understanding is that they're saying is that the money had been fully appropriated based on the needs of that year. I'm not aware that there's a case like this where the secretary had a 336 hearing and that was ruled to be arbitrary and capricious and the money at issue in that hearing, as a result, the secretary was ordered to restore that money.
Okay, this takes me back to understanding the mechanics of what a tribe needs to do when they believe that that HUD is improperly withheld money in a given appropriation year based on HUD's miscalculation of something that occurred in prior appropriation years.
They seek an order that the action is arbitrary and capricious.
Start even earlier than that. What do? They file a lawsuit somewhere?
They file a lawsuit in
where?
The district court.
Okay.
Of proper jurisdiction and proper venue.
How soon do they have to file that lawsuit?
Depends on the statute of limitation for an APA action.
Let's assume APA statute of limitations is 6 years.
Right. So they have 6 years.
They have six years? Like, okay. So in 2004, mm-hmm. a tribe feels like HUD has improperly withheld some money from a grant. Mm-hmm. They have until 2010 to file an APA action?
Yes.
Okay.
That's the statute of limitations.
And then what do they do? Do they say, we want recovery of those funds that were improperly withheld in 2004?
Right. And so the problem is, and what's happening in the 10th Circuit case is, in the case where funds have been set aside because the tribes have first gone to district court and asked for an injunction to ensure that those funds are not appropriated to all other tribes as required by 4151, they basically stop the allocation. And if they stop the allocation,
So you're saying the
statute of limitations is meaningless.
Yeah, I don't understand. You just told me they have 6 years to file their action. Now you're telling me, no, they have to get in right away.
Yeah, they can file anything that they want as long as they don't want any relief.
Because HUD might spend all the money and exhaust all the appropriation funds. So what would be the point of filing something in 2010?
Well, there wouldn't be. I'm simply saying as a matter of...
There wouldn't be a point is what you just said.
Right. There would not
so
be a
point. So what you just told me is a farce.
No, the district court has the power it has.
It's not a farce?
The district court may not award damages, and if what they're seeking is damages, which is our view of what is being sought in the particular case in the 10th Circuit, then the court has jurisdiction to award.
What could they possibly get in 2010 if they filed an action 6 years after the miswithholding in 2004?
And I think we're saying they are nothing.
Okay, so it is a farce.
It's not. The law allows what the law allows. If they had gone in...
Okay, well... My question to you was premised on an ability to actually recover money, not just to have a lark in filing an action. Okay? What would be the way for them to actually get the money back that they believe HUD inappropriately withheld in 2004.
And what we've said is to get an injunction, a timely injunction. I don't know how long that would
well,
take.
Well, let's start with the beginning. So right. do they file a lawsuit?
They file a lawsuit.
In district court, under the APA.
Under the APA.
When?
Before the money is allocated. So, there's
okay.
so it's got to be within that year.
It could be a year. I don't know. There's been a discussion between the tribes, and the decision is made.
No, no, it's important to know when they need to get into court. Because it's, you're telling me it's contingent on getting into court before the money from that appropriations year is exhausted by HUD.
Yes, before.
Okay, so when does that happen?
Before.
In the very appropriation year?
I understand it happens under 4151, 25-4151, the secretary must allocate all monies for the fiscal year.
Okay.
How fast that happens, I assume once tribes put in their Indian housing plans, once they submit their grant monies, I believe it happens pretty quickly. However, there are more tribes that are part of the appropriation fund that may not get their actual grant applications in until a later date, and that money is held for them. How long? I can't tell you.
What was the effect of the 2008 amendment?
Pardon me?
What was the effect of the 2008 amendment? It seems to go back several years and contemplate recapturing.
It adopted HUD's regulation, which was at issue in Fort Peck. So HUD basically said that as part of the formula, that we start with the number of assisted housing there was when the statute was passed.
Right. It basically said you can't use that precise formula. You don't use that precise formula, and then said that as long as you file within 45 days, then you can go all the way back to several years before. So what was the point of allowing them to go back if there was nothing they could recapture?
I don't know what Congress was thinking. I do know that if they had a cause of action for specific performance, they could have brought that, obviously, in a district court.
But again, they would have had to do it even with this 2008 amendment. You're saying they would have had to do it during the original appropriation year? Congress keeps trying to get this money to the recipients, and it seems like you're trying to find every possible way not to let it happen.
No, it goes to all the recipients. If it doesn't go to one tribe, it simply goes to the other tribes. All of the money gets spent in that way. If you'd like further briefing on the exact timing, I'd be happy to provide that. If that seems like that.
Okay, so when they file the action, is that enough to freeze certain funds, or do they have to actually file an injunction order?
Injunction. So what was done in the Navajo case, and I can get you the site for that. In the Navajo case, the Navajo tribe asked that the secretary be enjoined from further distributing the funds so that there would be a target for the against which the district court could order specific relief by saying you're ordered to provide those funds to the tribes.
That's and did the district court in that case for Navajo grant the injunction request?
The court did.
The court did.
Yes.
Okay, so that's the mechanics of how you a tribe has to go about it in the government's view, mm-hmm. under the APA. Mm-hmm. You've got to get in early, mm-hmm. really early, mm-hmm. to protect yourself, and then you have to file some kind of motion for an injunction.
You have to.
And then if it's granted, then you're safe. Then you can finally litigate your case.
Then you can ask the court.
Anything else? Are there any other tricks to the trade?
I don't think there's any tricks. The court has the authority to issue specific relief, and that qualifies as specific relief. I mean, not award damages. But none of this has to do with the district court's...
But specific relief can't include the back year money that Congress was contemplating with the 2008 amendment?
If that money was set aside to identify a specific fund... But then becomes the target of the court's specific relief order, it can do that. That was what was decided.
Why is it that HUD can withdraw money from a later appropriations year for a tribe? Why isn't it that if HUD believes there's been some kind of overpayment in a prior year, it ought to go back and get the money from the tribe for that very appropriations year in which they were overpaid, rather than taking it out of the tribe for a later appropriations year? I mean, that seems like a fungibility notion going on between appropriations years when it comes to those funds, and yet at the same time, when the tribe wants to do that, to go get money back that it believes was improperly taken from them, they can't try to do that through a different appropriations year.
Because 4165 specifically provides the Secretary of certain remedies, one of which is offsetting any overpayments. Well, in the case of 4165, we're talking about an improper payment expended by the tribe.
Doesn't that contemplate a certain elemental fungibility to all these funds going across from one year to the next in the statute?
It's a specific grant of authority to the Secretary to do that, to offset against future funds, and that's exactly what happened in this case. After discussion with the tribes, that's what they elected to do. Again, this was not a case where...
So if the Secretary has the authority to do that, one would think that under the APA, a district court could order the Secretary to do that, even if it affects the payment of money.
The Secretary has the authority to do is recover those funds. As I said, in this case, the Secretary has agreed not to recover certain funds, and a district judge could...
But you've also said the Secretary has the authority to go back for prior years where there were underpayments and to make those payments from later distributions.
Under 336, the Secretary can make an adjustment to the Indian tribes or the TDHB's subsequent allocation. So in a following year, the Secretary has been given authority to make a retroactive payment
right.
following
So a district court conceivably could order the Secretary to do that for a lot of years going forward in order to make up for these payments that weren't made.
This becomes final agency action. The final agency action is subject to review, and I really haven't examined it beyond that.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said. That final agency action
is agency action. That, of course, is
subject to review. So if one challenged it in district court and said the Secretary acted arbitrarily by not doing this, the relief could be that the Secretary would do it, and then we'd be into this fungibility of funds in future years, right?
You'd be ordering the specific relief that the Secretary declined to grant an adjustment of whatever it was, and the court would hold that's arbitrary and capricious, and the Secretary would have to.
Yeah, so there is a way to do it, that the district court has authority to do it. It's just through the track of the statutory provision.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
I just want to make clear that our reference to strings attached is found in our reply brief at page 7, and our opening brief at page 17 will refer to the terms used by this court in NCMS. My reference to metaphysical only observes that in Bowen, the court said, it's not clear whether the Court of Claims would have had jurisdiction there, especially because the words were shall pay. It simply said in determining the district court's jurisdiction that it possessed that jurisdiction. It did not find the Court of Claims would not have jurisdiction, but found that jurisdiction was doubtful.
How does that help you?
It does. What we've drawn from Bowen is simply the fact that the court did not stop its analysis of the word shall pay. It looked further to see the true nature of the complaint, reflecting on the fact that injunctions and other...
Right, and it went out of its way to say it wasn't deciding whether the Court of Federal Claims would also have jurisdiction.
That's
just said that the district court did.
That's right. And so we don't need Bowen to win this case. It would be odd if NCMS and Bowen, which are very much like this statute, were to belong in one court, and in this case, were to belong in the Court of Federal Claims.
But both courts didn't actually say that it only had to be in one.
Did not say exactly that. The court at NCMS did say that to be considered was also the jurisdiction at issue was the jurisdiction of the Court of Federal Claims. So sort of examining it and saw it as two sides of the same coin. And because these monies could not be spent other than for a certain purpose, as here, the court observed that this court would not have jurisdiction.
Okay. I'm going to bring this to the end. We thank both sides in the cases.